let's tune out, so let's get started. In this talk, I'm going to be talking about some more advanced uses of PostgreSQL, some things that you can do that are a bit fun, some things that you might not have known before, and then a little bit of boring stuff about things that you probably want to put in place in your system, like point-in-time recovery. If you have a question during the talk, there's a guy with a microphone. He'll come over and run over. He's at the back there looking very nice. And he'll come over and you can talk into that so that we can all hear each other. So in PostgreSQL, those of you who studied computer science will be maybe surprised that it's actually Turing complete. By that, I mean that anything that can be completed on a computer can be implemented inside of PostgreSQL. However, we're not going to build a web server today, which is a shame. Why is it Turing complete? Well, SQL by itself has every condition of Turing completeness except for a loop construct. We have a set returning function in PostgreSQL called generateSeries, which can generate a loop of arbitrary length, and the way you use that is just as follows on the screen. Select generateSeries, and it will output rows in series as it shows. So that means we can do some fairly cool stuff. Like, say we wanted to list all the days in the last week. We could do it as follows. We select generate series here, 7 days. We subtract this from the current date, today, and we do a little thing here which SQL allows us to do, which is that we multiply this integer from generate series 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, by 1 day. And we subtract 1 day, 2 days, 3 days, 4 days, and so on from the current date. We cast it back to a date because an operation between a date and an interval results in a timestamp, not in a date. We cast it back to a date, we call it the day, and then we get a list of days, which is pretty cool, I think. But let's do something actually useful with it. PostgreSQL, if you're using it now, one of the reasons why you might be using it is because it's highly extensible. We talk in the manual about this extensibility and all that kind of stuff. What do we mean by that? Well, in Postgres, unlike pretty much any other database that I've used, we can just arbitrarily create an aggregate. The aggregate I'm choosing to create here is one called Array Accum, or Array Accumulator. It's detailed in the manual under Create Aggregate. There's no sort of secret. And we specify two important arguments. The first argument is our transition function, how we're going to add new values to the aggregate. And the second argument to the function that's important is that the input data type is any array, which is effectively any piece of data. And we set the initial initial value of the transition value to an empty array. Why are we doing this? Well, we might want to reduce or aggregate all these rows from generate series 1 through 8 into an array. And once we do that, we can do some fairly cool stuff. I'm on the third or fourth slide or whatever, and I'm building histograms in SQL with just a couple of lines of SQL. What I've done here is that I'm selecting values out of a hits table. The hits table is just a table I'll use for the rest of the talk, which consists of two columns, a date and a user ID field. Let's just say we're monitoring usage of an application. We put, every time someone uses the application, we put an entry in hits. So in this example, we want to look at how many hits or how many times the application was used on a couple of days. What we do is we select D, the date entry, we run a count, we group that count, so we're counting by day, that is the date is the grouping field, but we also put this argument in, array to string, and it allows us to construct this histogram here, which is basically the count on the second column. So that's a pretty nice little trivial use of this kind of functionality, which you might not have known beforehand. Speaking of grouping, most people don't know just how much you can achieve with grouping. Remember I said before that in PostgreSQL, the SQL layer is Turing complete. That means that even the features that we do not have from other databases, like window functions, if you're familiar with those on Oracle or on DB2, we can implement the same semantics inside of PostgreSQL, but just at the expense of typing more SQL. So one thing that people often ask for is a running total in a report. And that's how you would implement a running total for the our hits table. So we want to know the hits for a given day. The day is the grouping field, 2007, the 1st of January, the 13th of January, 14th and 15th of January. We have our fields, and then we run an accumulator on the third column. Now have a look at how we actually do that. We're summing up here h2.count, and where we get h2.count from is from this part, is from the second argument of the join. The important way in which we can actually do the running total is that this is more or less a self-join of the same query. We're saying that h.d, which is d from the first subquery in the from list, we're saying that we want to match rows which are greater than or equal to the second case, and therefore we will get all previous days whenever we run this report. So that's how we get the running total. Did anyone have a question about that SQL before I continue?
That means you're going to iterate over the full count of hits twice?
That's right. That's the cost of having done that. And the semantics actually require that we do that, because we're summing up as we go, and because we don't have these special things called window functions, we can't actually do it very efficiently. But if the choice between doing it efficiently and doing it at all, well,
yeah,
you just do it. But yes, we are executing the same query twice. Are there any other questions before I move on? Okay, so beforehand I said, just on the slide, well, why don't we do it for the last week? Well, it just so happens that in my test data there was only three dates that the data occurred for. But what happens if we want to actually do it for a single week? There are two things we need to pay attention to. Firstly, we need to limit it to just being a week. You'll notice in this query, we don't actually limit the range of the date at all. We want to limit it to be just a week. And secondly, we want to count dates for which there was no hit. And you'll see in the result down the bottom that I've managed to achieve that. This SQL, however, is reasonably ghastly. So let me explain. There are two queries in the range table, in the from list that we're interested in. The first is we fetch the data, and we perform this right out of join here when we're fetching the data. And we join against our generate series data. And the reason why we do that is that we want to do what I did back on one of the first slides, which is that we want to get this range of dates in the last week. Once we have that here, we right join it against a grouping of the hits table, and we group it on the dates being equal and on HD, that is the actual lead from the hits table, being within the last week. And what that gives us is, and I'll show you if my laptop actually works, what that gives us is a count of the last week and a zero for each case where we didn't actually match it. So if you look in the first example, it gives us this data, but zero entries for the situation where we don't have any. How we actually get the zero is in the target list here. Notice the coalesce function. What coalesce does is it says that if the first argument, which is the sum, is null, then return zero, the second argument. when you pass null to an aggregate, the aggregate returns null. So if I didn't do that, instead of zeros under the run column, there would just be white space on these slides, or null if you were using an application. So that's how we take care of that aspect of it. We also want to be able to do the running total. So instead of putting h.count, which would give us the count for each day, and a zero for each non-match, we sum up h2.count, which comes from our second query, which we've left out a joined against, and we sum those up to give us the running total over time. Does anyone have a question about that SQL? It's reasonably unwieldy.
Couldn't you do couldn't you do the running total with an aggregate function?
Yes, if you do it like this. What I recommend... this basically is two passes. See the count...
But without two passes.
Oh, sorry, without two passes. I recommend, as an exercise, you go and attempt to do it, but your SQL will end up looking like this. But I do recommend you actually do it. That's where the insight will come. The answer is no, you can't do it. And the reason why you can't do it with a single pass is that such a concept is implemented, and this is the reason why they were implemented in OLAP rollup. I'll show you on the next slide something which explains more why it has to be done in two passes. That is, I'll represent this data slightly differently. Just again, was there any other question before I proceed? Good. So we can do this differently in SQL. The actual running total style report, or the grand total report, is called a roll-up report. The running total is usually called a data cube. So say we want a grand total. This is how we would do it in SQL, and this is how you can do it right now in SQL. So we group on the condition the expression that we want, which is by day, because we want to accumulate things by day, and then to find a total, grand total, we select null. I can explain that if anyone wants, but it should be self-evident. And then we count all hits that we will have matched. So we get a running total and then a grand total. Sorry, not a running total. We get a total for each grouping expression, so for each date in this case, and then a grand total. We could expand this to be more complex if we wanted to include the user ID field, which is in this hits table as well, so that we could have grouping by date, grouping by user ID, and counts. And there would actually have to be, six selects by that time. No, four, I think. Four selects by that time. But I recommend that as an exercise, those of you who would like to learn more, create this little table like I've done just based on the slides. I'll put the slides on the LCA website after the talk. Create the example. I can provide the SQL if anyone would like that as well. And try to do it with two dimensions, that is the date dimension and the user ID dimension. It's actually an order of magnitude more complicated. If you imagine a very complex report with, say, 9 or 10 dimensions, you would have hundreds of lines of SQL, which this is why we do need this thing of window functions, which happily I'm now working on. Are there any questions before I move on? To be able to do the data cube, how many people here are familiar with data cube? Okay. Or sometimes they're called crosstab. So you can do data cube as well. I would recommend attempting data cube as well. What has to happen in data cube is, well, you should look at an example of a data cube and understand how each different expression is summed up. So every single related dimension is summed up or is aggregated in the data cube or crosstab report. You can actually do it with exactly the same approach as this, just with union all, but it requires the number of queries is 2n minus 1 or something like that, where n is the number of grouping expressions. So if you had 10, then you've got 1,023 queries, which is not much fun. So I guess talking about this complex SQL and the implications of running lots of SQL moves us along to increasing the performance of SQL. First things first, you should have on your production systems log min duration statement turned on. This will allow you to catch extraneous queries that didn't come up in testing or receive different arguments or something like that, and you didn't know that the queries were going to perform poorly in production, or maybe just a regression in the data, or a regression in configuration, or regression in the application. Set this to a realistic number. Usually I set it to about 1 second. It depends on the application. Like if it's a reporting server, well, then most reports take more than a second to produce, but shouldn't take more than maybe 30 minutes. I set it to 30 minutes in that case. Of course, the strategy should be to solve the easiest things first. So take the longest query and tackle that one first. How many of you are familiar with Explain? Excellent. Well, there were lots of hands that weren't raised, so I'll be explaining Explain. Explain is a query debugger, basically, for PostgreSQL, built into the SQL grammar. What it tells us is, when we just run explain and say select star from foo, it tells us what the planner has guessed about the underlying table and what it is instructing the executor to do. Planners and executors are really interesting pieces of software. They often lend themselves like dynamic programming. And so if you're interested in genetic algorithms and neural networks and stuff like this, SQL query planners are really the place for you. Some of you might have seen Neil Conway's talk last year on PostgreSQL query optimizer. Because they're undertaking a complex task and actually planning declarative SQL is NP complete, so we aren't sure that we can actually plan every SQL query. So that means we need a nice debugging tool to be able to find out what's actually going on when we plan this query, and that we know a priori how a query will be executed inside the executor. In this example, what I've done is just said select star from hits where D equals the current date, the time right now, or the current date. And I see from explain analyze that it's using a sequential scan. What a sequential scan is, so we have this table hits here. It's organized on disk like this. It's all our rows taking up and stuff like this. These are just 8K blocks here. Sequential scan literally means we read from here to here, pulling out the data that we find matches the predicate, that is the where clause, on the way. When these tables are really small, under 500 megabyte in size, with modern disk capacity, disk bandwidth and latency, we can scan this pretty quickly. In fact, this morning we were talking about the three-way RAID controllers. Well, they can stream like 200 megabyte a second off, so it's going to take 2.5 seconds to scan that whole thing. The problem is that if we get only a small number of matches, maybe there's one row that matches, well, why do we scan it? Scan spend 2.5 seconds to just get 8 or 12 bytes out of this table. So we have an index. And an index allows us to efficiently locate small numbers of matches. If you're unfamiliar with indexing technology, there's some discussion in PostgreSQL. Great discussion on Wikipedia and that kind of thing, but suffice it to say that by jumping to a couple of blocks in something like a balanced tree index, we can locate a discrete match within the table much faster than we can by scanning the entire thing. This is why, generally speaking, For the big range, map of data, up until you get into the terabyte range, indexes make a hell of a lot of sense. Because what this explain analyze, analyze actually executes the query, by the way, so that we can see actual real-time information. Explain analyze tells us here that no index is being used when we run the query. It's only taking a small amount of time, but given that we're only getting a small number of matches, it seems strange that we wouldn't use an index. The reason why we aren't in this example is that there are only 10 rows in the table. People often are frustrated with some database technologies when they don't use indexes. The problem with index technology is that you have to build a lot of this stuff. And all these things here are internal data. They don't have anything to do with the underlying table. They're B-tree or hash table or something, metadata for these index types. And these take up a lot of space. So sometimes you can be in a situation where an index takes up space comparable to the underlying table. That's because the underlying table's data distribution is sufficiently complicated that we need to store a lot of metadata. So for very small amounts of data, we don't need to use an index. In fact, Jim Gray, who works for Microsoft Research, despite working for Microsoft, is probably one of the most intelligent people in the world, proved that with modern disks, he did this last year, and some companies that I work for at the moment, we've also proved this as well. If you're going to read one byte of data from a well-tuned hard disk running, say, XFS, the cost of reading one byte of data from the table, uncached, is the same as reading 100 blocks of data with a 4K block size. So if we're going to read one row at the beginning, we might as well read the next 1,000 by that count. And 1,000 rows is basically programmed into PostgreSQL. When we're looking at indexes, if we think we're going to return more than 2.5% of the underlying table, then we don't see much point in using the index. The reason is that the index, in order to find the data, jumps around a lot. If you have a range query, that is, you know, ID less than 10, greater than 5, you're scanning a range of data, you may need to traverse a bunch of these index nodes. And these nodes, unlike in a sequential scan, aren't organized contiguously on disk. And disks hate nothing more than having to jump back and forth, because that's where the actual physics get involved. The head has to move, the platter has to spin, and these things are absolute constants in disk technology. So once you get to retrieving more than about 2.5 to 5% of the data of the table, depending on the nature of the data and so on, but that's roughly correct, you're better off with a sequential scan. But when you're accessing data through a primary key or a key of high cardinality in SQL vernacular, that is a key with many distinct values, you should be retrieving much less than 2.5%. So this is this is one of the fundamental things we're looking at with Explain Analyze. I think you had a question, but yeah. So what we're looking at here is in the first bit of information here where it says cost, we're looking at an internal measurement that PostgreSQL does. It doesn't guess how much time it might take. It is guessing how many blocks it will have to retrieve from disk, because a hard disk is the fundamental limiting factor in any database. RAM, accessing data from RAM can be done about 200,000 times faster than accessing data from disk. So that's why we fundamentally limit the planner to deal with blocks. And most planners that come from the System R, or what turned into DB2 era of databases, plan queries in this way. We estimate some other information about the table. And then we provide some actual information. The first item of data there says how long it took to get one tuple, one row. And it took 0.043 milliseconds. The second item of data tells us how long it took to return all rows to the user. We say here that we're going to filter on the current time. So that's our predicate, our where clause, and it was a sequential scan. Does everyone understand the structure of that that output? Because as you use PostgreSQL more, you're going to be looking at a lot of those. Okay. How do we know all this information about, you know, what the data actually looks like? You know, we've said here that we think there's going to be 10 rows in the table, 10 matches. We think that there's a certain number of blocks. The analyze command, not explain analyze, but just plain analyze command in PostgreSQL collects statistics about the underlying database. If you have auto vacuum turned on, it does this automatically in the background and puts them in this table, PG underscore statistic. That table stores information about the distinctness of values in each column, about common values, and allows us to guess when someone inputs a constant like the current time or current date, allows us to say, is this going to match many rows or is it only going to match some rows? If so, how many? How does that correlate to disk blocks on disk? If you're interested in this aspect of SQL, of databases, I recommend you have a look around the PG statistic table. Take a look in the manual as well. There's some commentary of the PG statistic table and how we store data in that. Can be very useful for debugging queries where you think that the plan has actually gotten something wrong. So we rely very heavily on these statistics, but they aren't updated in real time. And often performance anomalies, bad plans, as we usually call them, relate from poor statistics. In this example, this excerpt from an explain analyze, we perform a nested loop. A nested loop, I don't have my chalk anymore. A nested loop has performance of O(n) squared because for every output, for every outer row matched in the join, we perform a complete sequential scan of the inner table, the inner table in the join. So we repeat that again and again and again until we get results. The other queries, the other types of join, which are merge join and hash join, are more efficient, but they have a very high startup cost. In hash join, we have to hash all the values of the inner table, and that doesn't come free. In merge join, both sides of the join have to be sorted. So if we're reading data out of an index, then we know a B-tree index, then we know it's going to be sorted. If we're just reading data sequentially, or if the data comes out of a set returning function, or if it's the output of another join, we don't know that it's going to be sorted. We would have to sort it, then perform the join. So it has a startup cost. So for very, very small n, under a couple of hundred, nested loop is the fastest type of join. But over a few hundred, its performance degrades exponentially because it's O(n) squared. We can see here that there's been a planning error because the expected number of rows was 300. Was 30, sorry, which is fine for a nested loop. The problem was that the actual number of rows was 1684, which means that we've moved into the territory of a poor decision for nested loops. What we need to do in this situation, assuming that we have run analyze manually and we're still getting the same plan, is increase the accuracy of the statistics that PostgreSQL keeps on the join columns for those tables. What we mean by this is that because if you have a very large table, scanning the entire table when we run analyze will upset your I/O patterns, it'll might take an extremely long time if the table is very, very large. So we just want to scan a couple of blocks randomly, and if the data is well distributed, then we'll have an idea about what the underlying data looks like. Simple principle of statistics. By default, we scan 1% of the table randomly. What we can do is increase the percentage of which we actually scan. So what I usually do at this point is, if I cannot resolve this nested loop problem, I'll increase the statistics to 100 via this SQL here. What we mean by 100 is 10% of the table is scanned and 100 individual datums are stored in PG statistics, so 100 data points per column. So 100 distinct values, and those distinct values are fed into the planner so that when someone says select star from accounts where ID equals 1, if ID equals 1 is in that PG statistic table, then we know exactly how many matches that we'll get. So by doing that, we can greatly increase the accuracy of plans, and usually that results in much more accurate queries. Does anyone want me to explain that further?
Just on the create table syntax.
So alter table accounts, alter column, user ID, set statistics equals 100. You can also upgrade postgresql.conf and change the default statistics target setting, which is set to 10 by default. But if you do that, when you rerun analyze, we'll honor that setting. Unless, of course, the value is higher for the other one. So sometimes, no matter how much statistics or how much we know about the underlying table, the planner just doesn't have enough options to do something useful. So usually in that example, we either need to add indexes, or we need to rewrite the query to behave in a way that is more suited to the planner. So following some pretty classic patterns that I've seen just over the course of dealing with PostgreSQL installations. So often it's just as simple as adding an index. We have a sequential scan here on the accounts table. The estimate is that we'll scan 2,000 rows. We get one result in reality, but it takes us 200 odd milliseconds to perform this. Unacceptable performance, basically. So we add an index and it runs sub millisecond. So really that simple. So those are the easiest ones to fix because you just run a single query. Sometimes the planner isn't able to use an existing index because of some transformation that has happened in the qualification clause, the where clause. So often you'll see people running queries where you're doing something like select star from people where lower, that is case fold the column to lowercase, lower first name equals lower input from web server. We can't use an index in that example, even if we have an index on first name, because So the index at that stage is organized with case. So this is how the data will be organized here. Gab and Gavin will not be contiguous. So we can't use a B-tree index in that example. What we need to do is to create a functional index, Postgres allows. How we do it is that we issue create index, an index name, on people, which is the table, and we pass in the result of the lower function of the column first name. What happens then is that when the data is received by the index, the data is already case folded to lowercase, so the data will be organized correctly in the index, and the planner is smart enough to see that someone has written someone's written something like that, and it knows in that situation that it can use an index because the two expressions are equivalent.
It does not wish that it is null.
Ah, yes, sorry. So the second case, and this is even more often overlooked, is that we can create predicate indexes, that is, indexes on actual where clauses. The chief way in which we would use that is with null values. Null values technically can't be indexed, at least not with B-tree indexes. Because in B-tree, equivalence is important. We're using less than, equals, and greater than. But null, by definition, is not equal to any other value, even itself. So we wouldn't ever be able to store null anywhere in the index. It just so happens that we store them in a special place in PostgreSQL for different reasons, but we cannot actually use the index for that. When we can use it is when we create a predicate index on start date is null. If the result of start date is null, or first name is null, or end date is null, is a Boolean expression. And it will always result in true or false. Either the value is null or it isn't. So then we can actually index it. Does everyone understand?
My question was, doesn't that yield cardinality of 2?
In this situation, it actually results in a cardinality of 1, because we're saying it is null only indexed when it's true. However, the planner is smart enough to know that this index isn't just on. It doesn't say that this index is all the values. It says the index is say 8 blocks, but the underlying table is 10 million or 1 million. So it says this is a tiny subset of that table. This isn't enforced as such, but it comes to the conclusion that that is less than, say, 2.5% of the table. Therefore, we use that over scanning this entire table. To say again, it's smart enough to realize that the is null predicate index is a subset of the table, and that anyone performing a query on that subset, as long as it's small enough, is better off using the index than scanning the underlying table. It makes the same calculation as if there was an index on the whole table.
Right.
I can explain further later on if you like. So another. I didn't think to talk about that, but there are a couple of considerations. First of all, if you lose power, you're screwed, which goes without saying. Say you've made that decision, and like you might just be working on temporary data. Cool. The best thing to do is to adjust this value in. PostgreSQL.com. So to repeat the question was, what happens if you're running your database on a solid-state disk or on a RAM FS or something like that? As I said, not a normal configuration, but maybe useful for your specific purpose. What that means is that random access to data has the same properties as sequential access to it. Remember I said beforehand that your hard disk is organized to read data sequentially. And when you read data randomly, it performs poorly. In fact, it's 100 times slower. But when you're reading data from RAM, accessing any data from any point in RAM is the same cost as reading it the RAM sequentially. So your random page cost would be 1. That is, accessing data via an index is equivalent to accessing data sequentially. So that's what you would do. And in that case, we would almost always use indexes over sequentially scanning data.
So that's the data over the cost of
This is the ratio of the cost of reading a block sequentially, reading a non-trivial number of blocks, say 1,000 blocks sequentially, over reading it randomly. So in with data warehousing loads, we set this value to 100 because we want to favor sequentially reading data. And that has to do with the way we structure the disk subsystem. That's what I was talking about, though. It's taking 100 times longer to read data randomly. It actually has a problem. It's a flaw in a B-tree as well.
Can you set that
around the page for the
query?
Yes, you can with set. 4. So the default value for random page cost is 4 in the configuration file. If you have a database whose size is roughly equivalent to memory, so say it's about a 3 gigabyte installation, about 4 gig of RAM, I usually set it to about 2. And you see them favoring indexes more. The reason why I don't set it to 1 is that there will always be a situation where the database might expand for some reason and go over the amount of RAM that you actually have. But if it's a read-only database, then you would set it to 1. Are there any other questions before I proceed? We're running a little low on time. So unanchored tables, what I mean by that is that in this example, we're selecting from 3 tables, from products, from parts, and from prices, but we no longer access the prices table. I usually see this when development work has been done on an application, maybe a junior programmer or someone unfamiliar with the project comes in, and they don't understand the relationship. They keep on accessing that table, and therefore, for every join of A and B, we read the prices table sequentially. Usually, you only notice it when the prices table gets sufficiently large. The giveaway is the distinct argument there, because the output of these two, if they're joined by primary keys, should be distinct already. So keep a lookout for those kind of tables. There's another good example, and I noticed that I even did it in my talk this morning. I made this mistake. Usually you have a foreign key relationship in your databases. What is often overlooked is on the foreign key, placing an index so that when you delete from the master table and it cascades to the child table, if you don't have an index on, in this case, part ID, we will have to sequentially scan the table every time we delete a row from the master table. If you add an index, the cost will only be an index access. Unfortunately, B-tree also has another problem, which is index bloat. What happens is that we have data organized like this. And they all join up back up the tree. There are some applications, say an index based on time, where data is regularly archived out of the table, where data is always being moved out of the beginning of the table in a first-in, first-out basis. So the beginning of the B-tree is always moving, but these blocks here remain empty. What we do in B-tree is that we rejoin those tables back into one as they shrink. But it's very difficult to do this efficiently, particularly if you have an extremely large delete. Say you delete a quarter of the table, and it takes maybe 30 or 40 minutes. Should the next query that comes along be responsible for cleaning up the B-tree? Well, it might take an hour, and the operation might just be select, through from bar, just one row. So we have a problem with pairing the B-trees in those kind of cases. So sometimes you see a situation where your B-tree index is extremely large, orders of magnitude larger than the underlying table. For those scenarios, we provide a utility SQL command called reindex. You simply pass the argument of the table, and it will regenerate the indexes for you, and they will be created in an optimal way, with as least storage required as possible. And often you can see an order of magnitude performance increase in your queries.
with the re-index, does it redo it completely from scratch every time, or does it
just...
It redoes it completely from scratch each time with re-index, yeah. It literally just basically reruns create init.
Do you have like a blocking factor?
Yeah, an index blocking factor, so that when an index block is pulled, it needs to be split into half how much the data gets copied into a new block.
Two-thirds of the block size.
That's a constant, and can that be modified to different kinds of indexes?
With 8.2, we have index fill factor.
Okay.
So yeah, 2/3 is the was the value recommended by the guy who invented balance tree. So it's like in the paper kind of thing. And it's always basically worked for us. Any other questions? Okay. So table spaces, which I wrote for 8.0, can have a huge effect as well. In this scenario, you have your machine. And you have various storage devices hanging off them, which are independent of each other, different controllers, all that kind of thing, or different channels at least. And you can create a table space to put your tables on and a table space to put your indexes on. And what happens here is that, say this is the table one and this is the index one, disks want to move in only one way. So when we read data via an index, we have these two blobs of data here. We look at the index, then we read a block from the underlying table. Then we read another couple of bytes from the index, we read another block from the table. Very, very random I.O. and the platters and the disk head is just jumping around everywhere, all over the disk. Not how disks want to behave. What they want to do is read things sequentially as they appear on disk, and they perform better that way. So if we have these two different storage devices, then when we read a datum from the index and then read a row, a matching row from the underlying table, what we can take advantage of is the fact that the disk head remains aligned and the underlying table head remains aligned as well. And this, under a heavy OLTP load that we tested it on, resulted in about a 33% performance increase. That's under a really intensive workload. We did have a pretty nice system, but it was a couple of years ago, so it can really have a massive effect. Another question here?
How's the stickiness of that related to dumps and moving?
Yeah, it comes out in the dump as well. Yeah, we honour it all and lots of things. You just do it once and forget about it.
If you've got a big RAID 10, say, are you better to cut that in half and do something like that, or do you just, are you likely to be better to just rely on the striping?
Testing is always the best result. It depends largely on the workload. Usually I would go for RAID 10 before splitting to table spaces, I would say. If you have like one table, though, like a really important data warehousing table, fine. Well, no brainer. Get rid of the striping, have two sets of mirrors, and yeah, but it should be derived from testing. So data partitioning, quickly, we're 5 minutes over the end of the talk. Say our hit table from the beginning of the talk gets really, really big. Orders of magnitude larger than what we were anticipating. Well, we can partition, as I've said here. I do like to partition my databases on the weekend. We can partition. Unfortunately, iSpell doesn't really work very well on text files, so I don't tend to spell check these. We can partition the data using constraint exclusion, or constraint exclusion, as it should probably be spelled for consistency. Constraint exclusion basically means that we create constraints on each part of the partition, and the planner is smart enough, or the system is smart enough, that when we're running a query, we know which parts of the partition to select the data on based on the data in the where clause. So in the case of our hits table, say we had partitions which had constraints breaking up the data by month. Each subtable or partition would only store data from a distinct month. When we say select hits where date equals the current date, which is the 16th of January, we'd realize it was January, go to the January partition and not scan the entire hit table. The reason why we introduce data partitioning is for this middle ground of problems where we have this large table, we want more than 2.5% of it or more than a small subset, but it's not 80%. It's sort of this grey area just like this. And we can take advantage of the power of sequentially scanning data rapidly from a modern disk whilst still scanning only small amounts of the data. So how we set it up is to use inheritance. You'll be able to see here that we use this inherits construct. So in that situation, hits 2007-01 has no columns. It inherits all the columns from the parent hits table, and we create a rule such that whenever someone inserts to the table hits, instead of inserting into that table, it inserts it into the child, which happens to be 2007-01, if the date falls into the month of January 2007. So using a rule is another example of how extensible PostgreSQL is, and allows us, is a macro for rewriting a query. An interesting exercise to learn more about partitioning, more about PostgreSQL for you would be to come up with a different way of redirecting the input into a target partition. The rule rewriter doesn't work very well when you go beyond 100 partitions because it's like, you know, O(n) to the power of 3 in terms of performance or something like that. Very, very well suited for a small number of partitions, not well suited for a few thousand. But you can create a mechanism with a before trigger which runs in constant time, irrespective of the number of partitions. So those of you who are eager to learn more, I recommend you do that if you actually have some spare time. So, materialized views. Application developers love doing stuff like that. Select staff from accounts. And they love putting it on every page 3 times. They're in the same query each time. And it runs really fast when there are like 3 accounts when they're testing it. It runs really bad when you put it on the front page of Wikipedia. So here's what we can do with PostgreSQL, or what's called the Lee Taxor's way. We create another table, which is something of a materialized view, called accounts count. We insert the existing count in there, so it might be 2000 or something like that. We create a rule on the accounts table such that any time a new account is added, we update the current count, so we increment it by 1. So that means that if we add 10 new accounts from our application, the count will go up to 1010. We display that on the front page as many times as we like because accessing that one row doesn't cost very much. The problem is it doesn't actually work for delete or update. In the example of an account situation where you never delete accounts, well, that's fine. But you might need it and probably will need it for other situations. So that will be another exercise. You can use triggers pretty much in the same way that you do for the partitions. You can use a before trigger or an after trigger to update the count. So I recommend you...
So I've just got a question. I know I think it might be new in Postgres 8. Is there an advantage of using rules over triggers? Because I know triggers are a bit older, as far as I can tell.
Triggers are, in Postgres at least, pretty much as old as rules. Rules are just simple to use. At least I have it turned off. At least it's fun. It's horses for courses. You can see how small that create rule was. The reason why the trigger example isn't on there is it wouldn't fit on the slide. So you can do more, but it comes at the cost of more complexity and more code. So sometimes the old ways are actually the best. Some of you will probably be familiar with curses. Not everything these days runs in stateless web applications, and curses are often overlooked. But running queries through curses on Postgres can result in many orders of magnitude speed up. how a cursor works is that you save the query plan as it's running and can re-access that query plan and move back and forth within it. So that instead of, if you just want to paginate through results, usually people just look at the first couple of pages of results or something like that, or go to page 5 because it's the page they always go to or whatever it is. They don't want to look through all the results. But when you run the query, you're actually producing the entire result set. Each time someone looks through the page, each time someone presses reload or refresh or something like that. So if you have a stateful application, like a client web server written in Java or something like that, then cursors can work extremely well, particularly in situations where the client side has a small amount of memory, because then you let your BT Postgres server manage all the output tuples, and your low-end client doesn't have to have huge numbers of results stored locally. So it can be pretty useful. So I'll quickly just wrap up with point-in-time recovery. Some of you have probably heard of this, and I spoke about it off and on this morning. Point-in-time recovery, or continuous backup in PostgreSQL, works by archiving the write-ahead log or the journal. So in Postgres, just like in Oracle or a variety of other databases, before we write to the database, the actual underlying table, we put a little entry in a write-ahead log, or WAL. Saying exactly what we did. So that if we crash at that point, this can be replayed, just like EXT3. Because this tells us exactly what's happening in the system, well, we can just put it on another machine, replay it, and those operations will happen on that machine. That's exactly what we do with point-in-time recovery. To get started, what we do is we define an archive command, a command to ship the logs to some other place. So in this case, we're going to send them to a backup server. We're going to do it using SCP. We could use any variety of network transmission tools. %P is the name of the local file, the local write-ahead log. We don't actually know what it is. This is the placeholder. %F is the destination name. We just need to place those somewhere as source and destination within the archive command. We then need to perform a base backup. This is just a snapshot of the existing state of the system. You've probably learned or been told or read that in PostgreSQL, you cannot back up a running system just using tar or rsync or cpio or some NetApp file system snapshot tool. Well, combined with the write-ahead logs, you can. So if you follow the following procedure, you just run pg start backup with some unique identifier, you tar up pg data, then you call pg stop backup, and then you're away. Combined with the write-ahead logs which are being actively archived, because you've defined the archive command, if you have to replay a system because of a failure of some hard disks or put it on another system for testing purposes or failover purposes, untarring that dump, the dump itself will be corrupted. It'll be missing some data because the data is only in the write-ahead log. And once you've replayed the write-ahead log, all those items of corrupted data will be fixed. And we do it in this way. If we have to recover, like the fearful day has come where the RAID control failed or whatever it is, we stop PostgreSQL. We save the PG data to look around later on, to work out what went wrong or something like that. We remove all the files under PG data base under all table spaces. We restore the base backup from the tar archive. We remove any files from PG underscore xlog. And then we copy those files and save them for later on. We create a configuration file, which I'm about to show you, and we restart PostgreSQL. The configuration file looks something like this. It has a restore command, which is pretty much the complement of the archive command, so it's just a means of retrieving the files, and we give it a time at which we want it to get up to. So let's just say the scenario was not one of a failed RAID controller, but rather an inexperienced developer accidentally dropped a really important table, and we don't have any way of getting it back. We know that they dropped it at about 10 past 11, so we roll forward to, we roll back to 11 o'clock. And that's how we would actually do that. So the nice thing about point-in-time recovery is that the point in time we recover to can be the present moment or the last point that we got to, or sometime back in the past. In case, you know, if something went wrong back then, we can work out what went wrong.
Are you planning to be able to do something like this to a running Postgres database so that you could put it into renoting mode and take a snapshot of the directory instead of doing copies or running on the live data?
There's something similar that I'm about to talk about in a minute, actually. So point-in-time recovery, you really need to, if you're going to use this, test it before you use it. It can be a little bit hairy. And test it regularly because configurations might change on your backup server. There are some other problems. The journal files and the base backups are obviously architecture dependent. If you do the UI system runs on, say, a Sandbox, and you're archiving over onto an Intel PC, well, assuming the Sandbox is running Spark, they're different architectures. You won't be able to replay the log. So it's not architecture independent. But usually most people relying on high availability and this kind of stuff have duplicate hardware. It takes 10 seconds to 1 minute to replay each file, so you need to keep an eye on just how many files you're accumulating. But as of 8.2, we can put the a standby machine into continuous replay, so it will be continuously up to date. You cannot actually connect to it and use it, which means you should probably look at Selenium 1 if you want to get that kind of functionality, but it does allow you to have a hot standby. And that's it, just as my voice is failing. Thank you. Are there any questions? Okay, good, because we're running way over time.
Predicate index.
Mm-hmm.